wing organizations?
Yes, so really the biggest witness that the prosecution presented was Kyle Scheidler, I believe is his last name, and he was presented as the expert on Antifa for the government. He actually works for a think tank that has been considered a hate group, and the director of that think tank has been exposed as being Islamophobic and having all these very right-wing, very conservative beliefs. This person got on the stand and he actually admitted that he helped write the indictment for the federal government. So the so-called expert on Antifa, which even the judge wasn't impressed about, was also the one who wrote this Antifa indictment for the federal government. I mean, beside him, we had dozens and dozens of officers from every imaginable agency, FBI, ATF, Alvarado Police, Johnson County, other towns police, all called on the scene after the shooting occurred, after the July 4th noise demonstration.
Javier, we just have 15 seconds. What happens next? They've been convicted of terrorism, eight of these protesters facing at least 15 years in jail each.
Yes. What's next is that the fight continues. There will be post-trial motions. There will likely be appeals. And as you mentioned, there are a lot of state cases that are still pending, not just for these defendants, but for other defendants that never had federal charges from the same event. And so the battle will go on in North Texas, and hopefully more people can support these supporters through their own resources, through attorney
Javier, we're going to
connections.
have to leave it there. Javier de Hannon, attorney with the People's Law Collective National Lawyers Guild. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. KBOO's Board of Directors meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland and online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Friday, March 20th at 6 p.m., KBOO makes everything metal. Somehow, the Metal March returns again in 2026, taking over even more of the airwaves. It's 12 whole hours of live bands and DJ sets from your favorite KBOO Metal hosts. March 4th and support metal on KBOO. Tune in to the Metal March Marathon, Friday, March 20th at 6 p.m. through Saturday, March 21st at 6 a.m. Only on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Trump administration appeals the federal restrictions on ICE using tear gas on Portland protesters. Wildlife conservation in Oregon gets a boost from a change to the state's lodging tax. And in international news, China and Russia find benefits in the U.S. and Israel's war on Iran. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, March 17, 2026. I'm Eric Leuschner. The Trump administration will appeal the federal court restriction on tear gas use by ICE officers in Oregon. Earlier this month, two orders from two federal judges restricted the use of tear gas and other chemical munitions near the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement building in Portland. Justice Department attorneys submitted a notice of appeal late Monday. The appeal seeks to reverse a March 6th preliminary injunction from a U.S. district court. That decision called for limiting crowd control agents in South Waterfront. Tenants of an apartment building across the street from the ICE building have said tear gas, pepper balls, and other munitions were violating their right to bodily integrity. A separate court order issued March 9th sided with the demonstrators, who said they were being subjected to tear gas to suppress their freedom of speech. That order also restricted the use of crowd control weapons. The specifics of the Justice Department's appeal have not been made clear. The notice of appeal stated only that they hereby appeal the decision. Attorneys for the federal government have already laid out some of their disagreements in court. Government attorneys Samuel Holt said in February that tear gas use is the result of demonstrators' actions, not federal law enforcement. They also diminished the legal argument that tear gas spreading into neighbors' homes amounted to a violation of bodily integrity. That argument is more common in cases where cities have ignored dangerous levels of lead in public drinking water. Holt also said that siding with the neighbors would be tacitly calling the tear gas use, quote, akin to the Flint water crisis, end quote. He added such a ruling would be, quote, an astounding holding. An increase in Oregon's transient lodging tax is expected to generate more than $30 million a year to fund environmental and wildlife conservation programs. The measure increases the tax on hotel rooms and other lodging by 1.25% and will fund efforts to conserve wildlife and preserve habitats. Mark Richardson has more on the story.
Oregon lawmakers have passed a bipartisan bill that increases the state's lodging tax to direct new revenue to statewide conservation efforts. The 1.25% tax is expected to generate over $30 million per year for environmental and wildlife programs. Colin Reynolds, program advisor at Defenders of Wildlife Northwest, says over time, advocates were able to overcome opposition from the lodging industry.
We had a coalition of over 100 businesses supporting this bill. We know that people who either visit or move to Oregon will patronize our business, so the better our environment is, the more people will come.
A 2024 report found Oregon's outdoor recreation generates $16 billion in consumer spending and supports 192,000 jobs. Reynolds says even with the increase, Oregon will still have the third lowest lodging tax in the U.S. In 2025, the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife identified 320 at-risk species, including the southern resident killer whale, American pika, and tufted puffin. Madison Kenny with the Friends of the Columbia Gorge says the new funding will fill a critical need.
This bill provides a smart solution to conserving the natural resources that fuel our thriving outdoor recreation economy. It is important to fund wildlife conservation proactively because it is far more expensive to respond once a species is close to extinction.
Funded programs include wildlife passage and risk reduction, anti-poaching, invasive species response, and wolf coexistence efforts. House Bill 4134 is awaiting Governor Tina Kotek's signature. For Oregon News Service, I'm Mark Richardson.
Washington and Oregon residents have a chance of seeing the Northern Lights on Wednesday night. That's if the clouds part and sky watchers can get away from light pollution. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration issued a moderate geomagnetic storm watch from the sun this weekend. The sun has a roughly 11-year cycle of magnetic activity that can create the Northern Lights, or aurora borealis, on Earth. Every 11 years, the sun's magnetic field flips. This year, the Earth exits that solar maximum, or the midway point in the cycle, which is actually good for seeing auroras. NOAA's Space Weather Prediction Center keeps a tonight and tomorrow night prediction forecast that can be viewed online at swpc.noaa.gov. The Environmental Protection Agency recently announced a proposal weakening emission standards for ethylene oxide commercial sterilization facilities. Critics say the chemical poses cancer risk for nearby communities and will end up leading to hundreds of millions in healthcare costs. Nadia Romligan has the details in Ohio.
The Environmental Protection Agency says it's preparing to loosen rules on emissions for ethylene oxide commercial sterilization facilities used to sterilize medical equipment and make other industrial products. Ohio is home to several of these facilities. The chemical has been identified as a likely carcinogen and is associated with increased rates of cancer. Janet McCabe, a former EPA deputy, says the new proposal is hard to square with the agency's commitment to protect public health from toxic chemicals. The agency also announced it's no longer quantifying the health impacts of its rulemakings. She adds, despite continuing to calculate the cost savings to industries.
But they are not putting a dollar sign on what it will cost the public in increased cancer cases and cancer treatment. Many people believe that this is very inappropriate and not justified.
According to the EPA, ethylene oxide is used to sterilize 20 billion medical devices, or 50% of all medical devices in the U.S. The agency argues relaxing emissions regulations is needed to help develop a secure domestic supply chain for critical medical devices. McCabe adds that ethylene oxide, like many other pollutants, is colorless and odorless. It's nearly impossible for Ohioans to know if it's impacting their homes, neighborhoods, schools, or workplaces.
And one of the things about sterilizers is that they tend to be smaller facilities. They're sort of, people aren't aware of them like you would be of a big factory.
The EPA previously documented nearly 24 high-risk ethylene oxide sterilizer facilities that have a cancer risk rate above the EPA's threshold. Research shows the chemical can increase risk of developing lymphoma, leukemia, and breast cancer. This is Nadia Ramlagan for Ohio News Connection.
The Trump administration promised to ban synthetic food dyes, including those used in cereal eaten by kids, as part of the administration's health goals. But the Health and Human Services Department has reversed course after Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. announced that labeling requirements would be loosened. Some experts say the move could allow companies to mislead consumers, or at the very least, cause confusion. Frieda Ross has more on the story.
The Trump administration has reversed its proposal to outright ban food dyes that have been known to cause health problems. Instead, Health and Human Services Director Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is asking food manufacturers to agree to remove 6 synthetic petroleum-based food dyes from their products. Thomas Galligan with the Center for Science in the Public Interest says the additives can cause acute behavioral problems in children.
They can become aggressive, they can have impacts on their sleep, and these types of effects when children are being exposed over and over again can add up and impact children's academic and social success.
Galligan says once a child stops consuming foods containing dyes, many symptoms go away. Kennedy has defended the move toward the voluntary agreement as progress that should encourage food companies to adopt safer, naturally derived alternatives. Unlike in the U.S., petroleum-based food dyes are strictly regulated in the European Union, which has caused food manufacturers to stop using them rather than provide a warning label. Galligan says marketing, not nutritional value, is why they're still on the shelves of American grocery stores.
They're just used to help companies sell their product. And so when we have this clear risk and no real benefit for consumers, there's really no reason for the FDA letting companies use these with no restrictions and no regulations to actually protect kids.
In 2023, California became the first state to ban 4 specific food additives, including red dye number 3. West Virginia also has banned some synthetic dyes, and Texas passed a law requiring warning labels. I'm Frieda Ross, Mississippi News Connection.
NATO allies refuse to help protect shipping in the Strait of Hormuz and risk becoming involved in the U.S.-Iran war. Illinois' voters consider opting into a school choice tax credit program, and a new farm bill proposal would shield pesticide companies from regulations. With that story and more, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2026 Talks.
Welcome to 2026 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
While taking the necessary action to defend ourselves and our allies, we will not be drawn into the wider war.
British Prime Minister Keir Starmer doesn't want to get into the war with Iran. President Donald Trump's demanding NATO, the EU, and others help reopen the Strait of Hormuz to ease oil and gas prices, but even Asian nations like China and Japan, dependent on the shipments, seem unlikely to send warships. Like many, Starmer says the UK will pursue diplomacy to end the conflict, which could further inflame the Middle East. Iran had in fact been able to increase its own oil shipments, even as it's blocking other tankers. U.S. airstrikes hit Karg Island, the terminal for most of Iran's oil exports, which could cripple that, but at the cost of more retaliation on neighboring Gulf countries. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer says the White House is operating without a plan and will make things worse before they get better.
Brent crude is once again above $100 a barrel. Right now, gas is $3.70 at the pump. Oil executives told the White House last week, no matter what happens next, prices are likely to rise even higher in the weeks ahead.
California's Santa Ynez oil pipeline is officially reopened after the administration used a Cold War-era law designed to increase wartime production. State lawmakers are decrying the decision since the pipeline caused one of the largest spills in California's history. Trump allies in the Senate say they're preparing to hold the floor continuously in an attempt to force passage of the Save America Act, a strict voter ID proposal. Voters in Illinois are weighing whether the state should opt into the federal school choice tax credit program. The ballot question in 30 counties won't be binding, but supporters hope it'll show statewide support for giving tax money to private and homeschooled students. University of Illinois Professor Emeritus Dick Simpson says they want to sway the governor ahead of an opt-in deadline next January, but he says the local votes have a critical limitation.
Because it's not being held in the most important democratic areas of the state, and it's primarily in counties that are Republican, that has less power.
Opponents say it would divert funds from public education and disproportionately benefit the wealthy. The Trump administration is pushing for increased production of pesticides like glyphosate, which European regulators say causes cancer. And a new farm bill proposal would shield pesticide companies from liability and limit states' ability to impose safety requirements. Brett Hartle is with the Center for Biological Diversity.
The farm bill basically seeks to immunize pesticide companies from that duty to warn. There's a lot of pesticides that are dangerous. They can cause very serious harm, including potentially cancers.
States like Georgia are enacting laws aligning with the stricter current standards, but Hartle says the new farm bill language would also loosen chemical company accountability, delay protections for endangered species, and allow unchecked discharge of the harmful pesticides in the environment. I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Hey, how are you? Listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on the Portland Community College strike. Then we'll hear from the Portland City Council Community and Public Safety Committee on an ordinance to ban law enforcement from wearing face coverings. At 6 o'clock, it's Transpositive PDX. Then at 7, Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with an overnight low of 51 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be cloudy too, with a high of 66. Today in history, in 1845, the rubber band is patented by Stephen Perry of London. The quote of the day is from Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who was born this day in 1933. Ginsburg said, quote, "Whatever you choose to do, leave tracks. That means don't just do it for yourself. You will want to leave the world a little better for your having lived." Charges have been dropped against Indigenous rights activist Nick Tilson since the jury in the case couldn't agree. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Prosecutors in South Dakota have dismissed charges against an Indigenous rights advocate, charges stemming from a 2022 incident against Nick Tilson, CEO and founder of Indian Collective, were dropped. In a statement, Tilson said, "My freedom was not granted by a judge, a jury, or the settler colonial court system. My freedom was won by the people, the movement, and the ancestors." Tilson faced more than 25 years in prison, originally facing charges of aggravated assault on a law enforcement officer and obstruction. Ultimately, the trial resulted in a hung jury. Tilson maintained his innocence throughout, saying it was an effort to watch an interaction between police and an indigenous member of the Rapid City community. Indian Collective spokespeople had contended the charges were excessive. In the same statement, representatives described them as, quote, blatantly politically motivated effort to silence a movement leader by criminalizing his actions. In response, Pennington County State's attorney writes, quote, the decision to dismiss the case was made after careful review and thoughtful consideration. The office adds they stand by the charging decision, saying while they believe the case was properly charged and presented, the jury's inability to reach a verdict was an important factor in evaluating whether further prosecution would serve the interest of justice. Alaska will receive about $1 billion from the federal government over the next few years to improve health care. The millions of that depends on the legislature passing several bills aligning Alaska with best practices for rural health care. Alaska Native people are much more likely to live in rural areas than other Alaskans. As Alaska Public Media's Rachel Cassandra reports, a proposal to make it easier for out-of-state nurses to practice in Alaska is facing fierce pushback.
When you boil it down, Alaska Hospital and Healthcare Association head Jared Kosin says joining a so-called license compact is pretty simple. He says there would be a set of criteria nurses would demonstrate.
And if they do, then they are issued a license and then they can practice in any states that use those same standards.
Proponents say joining a compact would help ease a nurse shortage across the state that's projected to worsen. Kosin says it may be simple to explain, but actually getting a bill passed to join the compact has been anything but.
It's just so snagged up in politics.
The last version of the bill was supported by most healthcare organizations in the state, but it was opposed by nursing unions. He says that created a toxic dynamic. And this year, there's new pressure on the legislature thanks to the Rural Health Transformation Program. When the state health department applied for the money, it told the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services the state would join the compact. The state's been directed by CMS to create compacts for other healthcare positions too. Physicians, emergency medical services, psychologists, and physician assistants. The state doesn't know exactly how much money would be clawed back if Alaska doesn't pass all the required legislation, but a health department official wrote over email that a ballpark estimate is that millions of dollars is at stake annually and tens of millions of dollars over the 5 years of rural funding. Shannon Davenport is a union leader and nurse. She says there are many problems with the nursing field right now, especially workplace safety. And she doesn't think the nursing compact is the solution to them.
It's not the golden goose. It's not the answer to everything.
Even so, most nurses support a compact. Almost 90% of nurses living in Alaska, according to a 2023 survey. The federal deadline to join the compact is at the end of 2027. In Anchorage, with additional reporting by Eric Stone, I'm Rachel Cassandra.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
March is Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month, and doctors are especially urging people under age 50 to get screened early and take warning signs seriously. Once considered an older adult disease, colorectal cancer is now the leading cause of cancer death in younger Americans. Danielle Smith has more in Tennessee.
A new report finds colorectal cancer diagnoses are climbing sharply among people younger than 50, raising concerns among health experts. The American Cancer Society estimates over 3,500 new colorectal cancer cases and more than 1,600 deaths in Tennessee this year. ACS volunteer spokesman Dr. Bruce Waltholtz says the trend is especially troubling because nearly half of the cases in younger adults occur between ages 45 and 50. Yet only about 37% of Americans in that age group are being screened. He points out that Tennessee is seventh in the nation among states in terms of colorectal cancer mortality, which means it isn't being caught soon enough.
Screening saves lives. Colon cancer screening results in earlier detection. Colon cancer, when detected earlier, results in much longer-term survival, and higher cure rates.
According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, increasing the number of screenings for this type of cancer to 80% could reduce deaths by one-third by the year 2030. Waldholtz explains symptoms and warning signs that should never be ignored regardless of a person's age.
If someone has symptoms, which includes rectal bleeding, change in bowel habits, even at a young age, even people in their 20s and 30s, they should not ignore the symptom. So seeking medical attention when you have symptoms, change in bowel habits, abdominal pain, or rectal bleeding is very important.
Waldholtz says rising rates in younger adults may be linked to higher obesity, heavy drinking, and diets high in processed foods. He also urges families to talk about their health history and share the information with their doctor, especially if a relative was diagnosed with colon cancer before age 50. For Tennessee News Service, I'm Danielle Smith.
We now go to Global Citizen Commentary from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. He says the Chinese saying, taking advantage of another's misfortune, applies now to how both China and Russia are benefiting from the U.S. war on Iran. Their public diplomacy emphasizes U.S. and Israeli aggression in violation of international norms and the U.N. Charter, a position that will surely resonate with many Global South countries. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. I have previously commented about the strategic blunders the Trump administration has made in its war on Iran. Add this one, the gains both China and Russia have made at U.S. expense. While the war has had costs for both those countries, on balance, it has benefited both more. The U.S. war on Iran has put China in an uncomfortable position. With Donald Trump's official visit upcoming in April, the Chinese don't want to go overboard in their criticism. On the other hand, they have built up a strategic partnership with Iran, which includes relying for 13% of China's oil imports on Iran. And China sees opportunities to strengthen China's public diplomacy in calling out U.S. aggression, taking advantage of another's misfortune, as a Chinese saying goes. Accordingly, China is denouncing the U.S. war and rhetorically supporting Iran while doing nothing to upset the timetable for Trump's visit. In recent days, China's foreign minister and Communist Party Politburo member Wang Yi has set out the official line on Iran. Wang said, despite progress in the U.S.-Iran talks, the U.S. and Israel deliberately provoked a war against Iran, which clearly violates the purposes and principles of the U.N. Charter. China believes that the pressing task now is to immediately cease military actions to prevent further spillover of the conflict and avert an irreversible deterioration. As for supporting Iran, Wang Yi would only offer that, quote, China supports Iran in safeguarding its sovereignty, security, territorial integrity, and national dignity. Position in favor of seeming neutrality and mediation in the war, the Chinese leader seemed to believe, suggests that the longer the war goes on, the more will China's reputation strengthen and its influence in the region and in the global South as a whole improve. The contrast the Chinese leaders want to draw is between the U.S. destruction of Iran and partnership in Israel's decimation of Beirut on the one hand, with China's image as a responsible great power. I'd expect Vladimir Putin's response to the U.S. attack on Iran was meant to deflect attention from Russia's own aggression against Ukraine. Putin referred to armed Israeli-American aggression and called the assassination of Iran's supreme leader a, quote, cynical violation of all norms of human morality and international law. He should know. He has to feel relieved that the mantle of international criminal can now be shared with the U.S. president. Over the past year or so, Russia has lost important allies in Syria and Venezuela. Trump is predicting that Cuba, another Russian friend, is at the end of the line as it faces an energy crisis caused by what is essentially a U.S. blockade of Cuban oil imports. And now Iran. Moscow can do little to defend Iran, which, over the last 4 years, has become an important trade partner with Russia and at one time supplied Russia with drones. But if Russia's so-called comprehensive strategic partnership with Iran has been lost for now, Russia still may count important benefits from the war. First, Moscow has gained new justification for its war with Ukraine. If Trump can attack Ukraine without just cause, so can Putin attack Ukraine. It's all a matter of national interests, not international law. Second, Russia now finds justification for abandoning any pretense of interest in a settlement with Ukraine. Prominent Russian spokespeople are saying that the U.S., by attacking Iran, has lost all credibility as an honest broker interested in peacemaking. At any moment, these critics say, the U.S. might attack Russia. Best to keep fighting and defeat Ukraine. Third, Russian oil revenues are back on the upswing thanks to Iran's ability to disrupt tanker traffic in the Strait of Hormuz. Russia doesn't use the strait to ship its oil. Trump has lifted sanctions on imports of Russian oil, and China and India are paying higher prices for Russian oil, helping Russia finance the Ukraine war to the tune of an estimated $3.5 billion a month. The European Union countries may be forced to buy Russian oil before long. In all, U.S. defiance of international norms by rejecting a negotiated resolution with Iran in favor of a war that has affected numerous countries in and beyond the Middle East puts China and Russia in a comfortable political position. They are finding ways to support Iran, China via surreptitious oil shipments, and Russia via military intelligence sharing, ways that are risk-free and low-profile. The U.S. appears as an aggressor state, an unpredictable partner, a country whose behavior runs counter to its professions of respect for a rules-based international order. Beijing and Moscow will forever be reminding the world that Venezuela and Iran are models of U.S. foreign policy based on threats and the use of force. I'm Mel Gertow for The Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, March 17, 2026. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Mel Gertov, and Masato. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Mark Richardson, Antonia Gonzalez, Edwin J. Vieira, Frida Ross, and Nadia Ramligan. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in depth.